Okay, so now I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker. I had the pleasure of listening to Dick Beardsley speak 2 years ago at the Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge Banquet at Arrowwood, and I was certainly inspired by his story, a story of hope and perseverance and a great athletic career in addition to that. Dick Beardsley, he's best known as a runner for the 1982 Boston Marathon race that was dubbed the Duel Under the Sun, or the Duel in the Sun, where he was in a first and second place sprint to the finish at the end of Boston Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 53 seconds. And he took second place by 1.6 seconds. So I can barely drive 2 hours without getting tired. I can't imagine. Can't imagine running the whole time. So he had a real storied running career. And then beginning in November 1989, unfortunately, he had a series of almost unbelievable physical tragedies, different accidents and things that happened to him, and circumstances that came out of that. There were big challenges in his life. He is currently lives with his wife, Jill, and they're innkeepers and owners of the Lake Bemidji Bed and Breakfast. And he's been a fishing guide for many years, and you can find him running or fishing pretty much all the time. He's also the best-selling author of the autobiography Staying the Course, A Runner's Toughest Race. And so in honor of his running career, just want to share a Bible verse here from Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race that's marked out for us. And so if we could please all welcome Dick Beardsley.
All right. Thank you, Dustin. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Good afternoon. Great to be back in Alexandria. I was here, like Dustin said, a couple of years ago and spoke at the Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and that was a wonderful experience. And then I just saw Mike, where's Mike from Northwest Tech, back there. He's retired now, but I came and spoke, 20 years ago, Mike, right? Yeah, 20 years ago here in Alexandria. So, and I've done a little fishing here around the Alex area over the years, too. So great to be back in Alexandria. And thank you for letting me be a part of this wonderful celebration that you do every month. I really, faith has been a huge part of my life for as long as I can remember. And you'll hear some stories where perhaps that faith could have been tested a little bit. But before I go any further, there's a short little 5-minute video I'd like you to see.
The runners, and here again is the white cap of Dick Beardsley, number 3 from Minnesota, a running student of Bill Squires, with Alberto Salazar right in his hip pocket. Coach Bill Squires, that's the reverse of what you were suggesting.
Okay, Dan, this is what's happening. I had told Dick that he had to run Heartbreak Hill as hard as he could. The upper part he's going to try to be, you know, cool, but on the down part he's got to run it as hard as he can. In the snow blizzard 2 weeks ago, he did 7 miles in the blizzard, up and down the hill. Of course, the coach sat in the car and watched. So now here we go. This is his confrontation against the man, the great Alberto Salazar, who last Saturday, running against Rono, just missed the world record at 6.25 miles. Now what they're doing is they're running at under 5:02 pace up this hill and down it. They'll cover that.
Beardsley leading Salazar by just a step or two. Tremendous. Look how close these people are. Look at that pace. What's the pace like now, Billy?
They're probably running about 4:50.
Let's see if we get still. Look at that.
Start pumping, driving his arms and roll.
You got a lapse time of a little
record time they're shooting for is Seiko's 209.26 and Salazar's world record 208.13. And you just watch the clock in the upper right-hand corner. As we come down to the final mile of this race, they've been running about 5 minute miles since they took off at exactly noon today. This is one of the best races I've ever seen of the 8 races I've watched the Boston Marathon. This is a beauty. Literally 1-2 running with Beardsley hanging on to that 1 or 2 steps. Didn't it surprise you that Salazar's not blown past him by now?
No. Al has paid the price last week. Actually, he's been a hurt for a good month after. He's very fatigued. I can tell by Al's form. He's holding back, but he also is a big Al with a nice pendulum swing. He's working very, very hard. Now, Jack, there's a friend of mine, Ray Price, from the crew that are over at Hereford Street. We both written our book, The Run It, just a week ago. And he said, I'm going to take a picture from the upper floor.
Look at that.
Look at this.
Oh! Wow. That is the exact positioning that they've kept out for the last about 7 or 8 miles anyway.
The battle between
with you, these pictures coming in live as we come into the final half mile into the finish line, coming all the way from Hopkinton on a beautiful day with a temperature in the 60s. Salazar and Beardsley now neck and neck with a half mile to go. Salazar has now taken the lead. Alberto Salazar taking the lead. We've got a half mile to go. Record is 209.26, set last year by Seiko, and Salazar's world record is 208.13. You can see the clock on the upper right-hand corner of your television screen.
Looks like no world record today, but it's one race.
Having a lot of cameras right now.
All right, let's see. Bob Lavelle is on Hereford Street as they come off the particular area there on Hereford, turning out Palm Ave. Bob, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Jack. Thank you very much, and now it has come down to this. Alberto Salazar makes the turn up Hereford Street. The 1982 Boston Marathon presumably is in his pocket as he is out-dueled Dick Beardsley down the stretch and, in fact, took the lead on Commonwealth Avenue just under the Mass Avenue Bridge. And so is Alberto Salazar in front. Dick Beardsley in the hat behind. As Alberto Salazar comes up around Ring Road, will make the turn down Ring Road toward the Prudential Center. Alberto Salazar in only his third marathon. But watch Beardsley. Beardsley is making a move. It has come down to this. Beardsley and Salazar. The motorcycle's got to get out of the way. Here comes Beardsley. He's got to make a move on Salazar. Salazar looks behind him. It is neck and neck. One of the closest finish ever. Here comes Beardsley. Beardsley on the left. There's Salazar. Beardsley, can he have enough? Salazar kicking. Pushing off the final challenge by the win. The 1982 Boston Marathon. Let's watch it as it finishes.
Worn out. Oh my goodness, thank you. You know, it's hard to believe that that race was run 35 years ago this past April, and I can still remember it like it happened yesterday. And I've seen that video literally thousands of times over the years, and yet it still makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up every single time. And every time I see it, I keep thinking maybe this time I'm going to beat him. But you know, I remember after that race, of course, there wasn't texting and emails and all that stuff back then. But I got phone calls from buddies that were watching it back here in Minnesota on television or listening on the radio. And they're going, Beards, you mean to tell me you couldn't make up 1.6 seconds in a race that's 26.2 miles long? I tried. It wasn't that I didn't try, that's for sure. But a lot of people, they see that video or they look at my running resume and they think, man, this Beardsley must have come out of his mother's womb with a pair of running shoes on. That I was a Minnesota State High School champion in cross country and track, went on to a major university on a full ride scholarship, on to the Olympics and so on and so forth. But for me, it was about the exact opposite. As a kid growing up here, my whole world growing up revolved about the outdoors, mainly hunting and fishing. It was my passion. As Dustin had mentioned, I started my own fishing guide business when I was 12 years old. And I do it to this day, and I absolutely love what I'm able to do. And I also milk cows, and I just really love the outdoors. And when I got into high school, I was kind of a nerdy kid. I got picked on a little bit. I guess you'd call it bullying now. But I kind of worked through that, was able to work through that a little bit. And my desires of having a girlfriend never even crossed my mind until I was 17 years old. And I was just starting my junior year of high school. And I'll never forget that first day of high school, my junior year in September of 1973, when I walked through those high school doors that morning. And when I did, it was like suddenly my hormones had changed. And for the first time in my life, girls started looking a lot better to me than a dead raccoon laying alongside the road. But I was way too shy and bashful. And I tried calling a girl on the phone. I was able to get her phone number from a friend of a friend of another friend. But as soon as she answered the phone, I hung the phone up on her. I mean, I wasn't real cool with the girls, that's for sure. But I noticed this. I noticed that a lot of my buddies that were good in athletics, wearing their high school letter jackets around all the time, they had girls hanging all over them. I'm thinking, yeah, that's it. I'll just earn myself a letter jacket, and the girls will come to me. So right then and there, I decided, I'm going up for the football team. Well, look at me. You know, I'm 6 foot tall, weigh 135 pounds, soaking wet. But I was bound to determine I was going to be a football player. My coach and gym teacher tried to talk me out of it, but I wouldn't listen. I'll never forget that first day when we ran out onto that football field for our first day of practice, following our coach Schaefer out onto the field. We're at about the 50-yard line. We've got this big circle in the middle of the field around Coach Schaefer, who's holding a football in his hand. When he hollers as he throws the football, Beardsley, fumble, get the ball. So I'm thinking, I got to show Coach I know how to play this game. So I took off sprinting as fast as these skinny little legs would take me, and I pounced on that football. And when I did, moments later, about 20 of my teammates hog-piled on top of me. Now, when I fought my way out of that massive humanity, when I climbed out of that pile of guys, my helmet was on crooked, my shoulder pads were sticking out, my football pants were down to my ankles, and at that point, I'm thinking, there is not a girl alive that is worth going through this. So I quit. I walked off the field. My entire football career from start to finish lasted 43 and a half minutes. That was it. So here I was at the time, a kid 17 years old. I never had a date with a girl, couldn't even talk to one on the phone. And now I don't last an hour on the football squad. What little self-esteem I had kind of went right down the drain. But sometimes what we perceive as our major disappointments turn out to be just an incredible blessing. And there's absolutely no doubt I was granted an incredible blessing. Because a couple of weeks later, or a couple of days, I should say, a buddy of mine said, Beards, I heard you flopped at football. You ever thought about going out for the cross-country team? I'd never even heard of that sport. I had two questions for him. First being, what is cross-country? He says, oh, we run up and down the hills, jumping over logs and creeks. I'm thinking, man, that sounds like it might be kind of fun. But my second, way more important question to him was, do they tackle you in cross-country running? And when he said, no, they don't, I went out for the cross-country team. I showed up for my first day of practice. I was so excited. Didn't even own a pair of running shoes. Had an old pair of canvas Converse on. And our coach says, all right, boys, line up out in front of the school. On the road out there, we're going to do the around-the-block run. Now, I'd never run before, but I knew this. I knew I was dedicated enough and committed enough and stubborn enough that I could surely hang with my teammates to go around the block. So our coach lines us up out in the road. He steps off to the curb. He takes his cigarette out of his mouth. They got anybody they could back then to coach cross country here in Minnesota. And he blows his whistle, and off we go. We get down to the end of the first street. I'm right with all my teammates. We turn left. We get up to the next street. I'm still with all my teammates. We turn left there. Now I'm thinking, okay, we get up to the next street corner. We turn left. Back to the high school. Practice is over. Man, I'm going to like this cross country. So we're coming up onto the next street corner. I start leaning to the left. They keep going straight. I'm thinking, well, I guess they're feeling pretty good today. They're going to run two blocks. We get up to the next street corner. I don't just lean left. I actually turn left. They keep going straight. At that point, it feels like somebody's got their hand down my throat trying to rip my heart right out. It feels like my lungs are about ready to explode. And pretty soon, we're out of streets and town and out into the countryside, and they're so far in front of me, I can no longer see anybody. Thankfully, somebody came back, one of my teammates, to where I was struggling to put one foot in front of the other and says to me, Beards, follow the road you're on all the way to the end. When you get to the end of this road, turn left. When you get to the next road, turn left there, and it'll take you back to the high school, and off he went. Well, what I found out there around the block run was actually 3.2 miles long. Now, that doesn't seem very far to me today, but back then it seemed like forever. I had to walk the last mile. I could not run it. By the time I got back to my high school parking lot, all my teammates and my coach had already showered and gone home. But when I crossed that imaginary finish line, I remember thinking to myself, gosh, Dick, I don't know how far you just ran and walked, but you made it. And I'll just bet you, Dick, if you work real hard, if you believe in yourself, have faith, I'll just bet you, Dick, you can get good enough to earn the letter jacket as you make the varsity squad to get the date with the girl. That was my whole inspiration for running, was to get the date with a girl. Unfortunately, or fortunately, perhaps the way you want to look at it, I was terrible. I did everything I could do. I did everything my coach told me to do. I ran on the weekends when I didn't have to. I didn't complain about any workouts, but I was terrible. Well, thankfully, our team had a JV squad, or I wouldn't have been able to run in any meets. But of course, you don't earn a letter jacket being on the JV squad. So I still didn't have a girlfriend when the season ended. Didn't have a letter jacket. As soon as the season ended, I quit running. Didn't run another step. Next spring, my coach says, so Beard, you're coming out for the track team, aren't you? I go, the track team? You mean that dirt road that goes around the football field? That circle? He goes, yeah. I go, I'm not running in a circle around the football field. Plus, it's fishing season anyhow. I'm not going out. And I didn't. But the day I got done with my junior year of high school, my goal was to run every single day that summer, and to make that varsity squad. And that's what I did. I ran every single day that summer, and we came back from my senior year of high school, my second year of cross country, and it was exactly 1 year to the day we did that same around the block run. But this time, instead of all my teammates finishing in front of me, they all finished behind me. Now, that's not saying a whole lot because we didn't have a very good team, but it showed me that if you're willing to put in the work and dedicate yourself to something and have that faith, don't let anybody, including yourself, tell you that it can't be done. Now, saying that, I never did qualify for a state meet in cross country or track, but I'd fallen in love with this wonderful sport. Now, a lot of people, when they see that video or look at my running resume, they think, man, Minnesota kid, probably went on a full ride scholarship and ran for the University of Minnesota, those Golden Gophers. Well, there was no scholarship. I did, however, run for the University of Minnesota. just not the one you're probably thinking of. I ran for the University of Minnesota / Waseca, a very small two-year agricultural college in Waseca, Minnesota, which is now a federal prison, so it kind of tells you about where I got my degree from. But that's a whole nother story. But I had a coach there, Dr. John Folkrod, who I'm still very close to this day, although he's been retired for a number of years. But one day he put his arm around me and he says, "You know what, Dick, I really believe you can become as good of a runner as you want to be." And I never, ever forgot that. But never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine that 7 years after I graduated from high school, that I'd be standing in that little town of Hopkinton, Massachusetts, getting ready for the greatest foot race in the world, the Boston Marathon. As you saw, nobody in that race gave me or anybody else a chance against Salazar. He was the world record holder. He'd never been beaten before. And yet it came down to basically a 100-meter sprint at the end. With about 900 meters to go, I had the biggest lead I'd had all day, an arm length and a half. And I knew Salazar didn't have a great kick at the end, but I knew he had a lot better one than I did. So as I pushed off to try to open up that gap, I got this gigantic Charlie horse in my right hamstring. And Salazar went flying by me like I was standing still. Pretty soon he had 5 meters, then 10, then 20. At one point he had almost a 100-meter lead. But I learned more about myself in those last 2 minutes of that race that has enabled me to get through way more difficult things in my life than that 1982 Boston Marathon. And what I learned on those streets in Boston over 35 years ago is that no matter how difficult the situation you're in is, no matter how high the mountain is to climb, is that you never, ever give up. It's about believing in yourself. It's about that commitment and dedication. It's about faith. It's about being in the right place at the right time. As I'm trying to work my hamstring cramp out, I'm trying to run the best I can, and I'm running along the right-hand side of the road when the crowd moved back to let me come by, and it was like the good Lord planted this gigantic pothole right on the side of the street, and I didn't see it. No, that's good. Because I stepped in that pothole. I stumbled and Pertner fell down. But when Pertner fell down, it jerked my right leg. And when it jerked my right leg, it popped the knot right out. Now I got back into the race. And as you saw there, it came down where I caught Salazar at the top of the last corner. And then it came down to a 150-meter sprint. And I got beat. 1.6 seconds. Half of me had never been so excited in my life because I was fortunate to run a personal best by about almost 40 seconds. But the other half of me was never been so disappointed in my life. I'm thinking, I just ran a 208 marathon. At the time, only one other person had ever done that. And I didn't win. And I remember getting back to my hotel and I was soaking in the bath, and I remember thinking, what could I have done differently? And I went back to Hopkinton in my mind, and I retraced almost every step of every mile. And when I got back from Hopkinton in my mind to the finish line, I was smiling from ear to ear, because absolutely nothing. When you know at the end of the day that you've given it your best, whether that be you finishing so-called first or so-called last, it was God's blessing that I finished where I did. I'll be honest with you. I don't think there's ever been a second place finisher in the history of running that's ever gained more out of a second place finish than me. Honest to goodness. But after that, my world just opened up. Sports Illustrated said not only will Dick Beardsley make the 1984 Olympic team, there's a good chance he's going to be a medal winner. My life couldn't have gone better. And then 9 months before the Olympics in 1984, I blew out my left Achilles tendon. There went 1984 Olympics. It was almost 2 years before I could start to run again. So I got back, tried to get into the 1988 Olympics marathon in Seoul, South Korea for those Olympics. I got to the Olympic trials, didn't run very well that day. And then when I finished that, I thought, it's time to move back on. It's time to go back home. I had a dairy farm. I was doing my fishing guide business. Still going to run just not at that high level. I was going to raise a bunch of cows, catch a bunch of fish, raise a bunch of kids, and life was going to be grand. And it was until November 13th of 1989. I got up that morning at 3:45 like I always did. I walked out of the house, out to my barn. I milked my 70 cows or so, got done doing a few other chores, walked back out of the barn, was heading back to the house to give my family a good morning hug and an I love you. Well, I got halfway between the barn and the house, and I stopped dead in my tracks, thinking about all the more important things I had to get done before I would go inside. I had 3 wagon loads of corn to unload. The neighbor was coming over to help me finish combining, and the weather service says a big snowstorm was due to hit the area in the next couple of days. I thought, you know what? I'll just tell my family I love them and give them a hug tonight at supper time. And instead of going forward, I turned around and went the other direction. Big, big mistake. Anytime you have the opportunity to tell the people you love that you love them, you never, ever pass on that opportunity because you don't know if it'll be there later that day. Mine almost wasn't. Instead, I walked down where I had a tractor parked. I jumped up on that tractor. I started it up. Pulled the throttle down, and that engine was a-thumping. And I walked to the back of the tractor, and I pulled a lever. And when I pulled that lever, it started a power takeoff. It's a long shaft. It spins at about 600 revolutions a minute. It hooks to another piece of equipment to run that. And as I pulled that lever, I turned around to go do something, and the next thing I realized, it felt like somebody had come up from behind, grabbed me by my shoulder blades, and body slammed me into the ground. The next thing I realized, my left leg was being wrapped around that spinning shaft like taking a piece of string and wrapping it around your finger. And when I couldn't take my leg anymore, it started taking my whole body around and around and around. And every time I'd come back around, I'd reach for that lever, trying to grab it, and I was always about this much short. And the thought of dying wasn't the scary part. But the thought of not seeing my family again was unbearable. And I could feel myself starting to lose consciousness, and I knew if that happened, it would be all over. Then on this very cold, gray November morning, all of a sudden, it got so bright out. It was like looking up at the sun times 100. What felt like I was spinning around like a fast top, now it felt like it was in super slow motion. And all that noise, it was as quiet as the inside of a library. Was I having a near-death experience? That's all I can tell you that it was. And as I came around that one last time, I remember throwing out my left arm, and it was like God had made my hand and arm grow just enough to where I could get my hand on that lever. I couldn't get a grip, but I could get my fingers on it. And when I close my eyes, I can still feel my hand slipping off. And I heard 3 words. And in my belief and faith, they were from God. Flick your wrist. That's the last thing I remember. The next thing I do remember is I'm standing next to my tractor and I'm about buck naked. It had torn all my clothes off. Now, I'm in shock, obviously. So all I'm thinking is, well, gosh, Dick, you stupid fool, you forgot to put your clothes on this morning. You better get in the house and get some on before the neighbor gets here. I had no idea I was even hurt until I tried to take a step towards the house. And when I did, I face-planted into the frozen ground. And I knew something was terribly wrong because my left foot was sticking in my left ear. And I'm not that flexible. At that point, it felt like my head was the size of a pumpkin. And I came to find out later that I had all kinds of head contusions. I'd broken all the ribs on my right side, punctured my right lung, broke my right arm, had a piece of steel driven into my chest, and my left leg was almost torn off. But I'm laying on the ground. I didn't know what to do. I knew I needed to get help. I knew my son Andy was off to kindergarten. I knew my then wife Mary was either in the house or out in the barn. But that will and that want to survive, and I'm praying to the good Lord, please God, let me somehow get to the house or somebody find me so I can get help to try to hopefully survive this. So I'm laying on the ground. I'm pulling with my left hand and pushing with my right leg, anything I could grab, like a snake slithering through the grass. I finally got about 100 feet away from the farm equipment when Mary found me laying in our driveway. And I could tell by the look on her face something was terribly wrong with me. She goes, "My God, Dick, what happened?" I go, "Mary, I got caught in the power takeoff. You got to call 911. So she sprints to the house. She gets inside. She grabs a portable phone. She dials 911. They're asking her all kinds of questions. One being, "Mary, is Dick still caught in the power takeoff?" "Just a minute," she says. "Let me go see." So she runs out next to me. Now, remember, I'm 100 feet away from any equipment. And she's screaming at me. She goes, Dick, they got to know. Are you still caught in the power takeoff?" At that point, I knew I wasn't going to die. I started laughing. I go, "Mary, does it look like I'm still caught in the power takeoff?" And she backs off a little bit. She goes, "Sir, I'm looking at him right now, and he's all wrapped up in that thing." I'm thinking, holy cow, she needs ambulance more than I do. Well, pretty soon, the sheriff comes pulling into the driveway, and I knew him, but he didn't know what to do. So he comes over and kneels down next to me, and he starts telling me Ole and Lena jokes as I'm laying there. And I'm thinking, well, at least I'm going to die smiling anyhow. But I had incredible doctors and nurses and surgeons and physical therapists and people I didn't even know. And the good Lord did not want me to go. And instead, because of the runner I once was, my accident got a lot of publicity. Not my doing, but it just happened. I was that close to death when God said, "Okay, that's enough." And within weeks after my accident, the University of Minnesota contacted me and said, "Dick, we'd like to send you out once you get out of the hospital and get recovered and speak to farm organizations and FFA and 4-H clubs around the country, around our state, and tell your story. Because we can send professors out there with all the statistics, but the fact that you survived," and that's what I did. For that point, life was pretty good for the next couple years. I was back running, back doing my fishing, back milking my cows, until July of 1992. I'm coming home from a little R&R from the cows. I'm 30 miles from home when a lady runs a stop sign on a country road and T-bones our car. Totals out my car, busts up my back, in the hospital, numerous surgeries to put me back together, but I survived. Even got back to running a little bit again. Things were going back pretty good until that winter. When I'm running in Fargo, North Dakota, down a street in a snowstorm, and I get hit by a truck. They find me laying in a snowbank. Back in the hospital, more surgeries, but I survived. Even got back to running just a little bit again. Life was pretty much back to normal until that spring. When I'm hiking at Lake Bemidji State Park with my young son Andy and his little buddy. Now this is before the park was really kind of more established. And I'm on this little narrow trail going up this steep incline. Thankfully, the boys are about 20 meters behind me. I get almost to the very top. I take one more step and this big chunk of ground breaks away and I fall off a cliff. I'm laying on the shore of Lake Bemidji. I can't move. I think I might be paralyzed. I yell up. I go, "Andy, stay away, but go get help." Well, he finally somehow got to the ranger station, and 30 minutes later, six voluntary firemen had worked their way down this big embankment, carrying a gurney board. Well, by the time they got down to where I was, they're a huffing and a puffing. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. If they're a huffing and a puffing coming down that embankment with an empty board, what's it going to be like when they strap me on and take me back up? Well, they get me all strapped into the thing. They pick me up three on a side, and they start going up this big embankment. Well, about halfway up, one of the guys says, boys, if we don't take a little bit of a break, we're never going to make her to the top. So they gently set me down. Well, after about 5 minutes, one of the guys says, all right, boys, let's pick them up and get them up into the ambulance. So they pick me up again, three on a side. But at this point, it's so steep, they can't just start walking up it. They got to get a little momentum going. So they're going a heaving and a hoeing. Well, about the third or fourth heaving, oh, they gave that gurney board a jerk. And when they did, the strap that was around my chin slipped down and tightened up around my neck. I couldn't breathe. When you can't breathe, you can't say anything. They finally get to the top, and one of the guys looks down at me and says, my God, he's turning blue and foaming at the mouth. So he takes his knife out, cuts off the strap. I get redness back in my cheeks. Now, you'd think that would be the end of the story, wouldn't you? Unfortunately, we still had about 400 yards through the thick woods to the ambulance. So they strapped me back down, picked me back up. They're blazing a trail through the forest. Halfway back to the ambulance, a pine tree branch breaks off into my right eye. They get me out to the ambulance. The guy goes, my God, he's got a Christmas tree sticking out of his eye. They got me to the ER. They didn't know if they should get the chainsaw out or what they should do. But I survived. I even once accidentally super glued my eye shut, but I'm not even going into that one. But honestly, through it all, not once did the thought ever cross my mind and look up and say, God, why are you doing this to me? Honestly, not once did that question ever cross my mind. Again, as I said earlier, I'm one of these people that things happen for a reason. And there was a reason why this happened, but there was also a reason while I was still alive. But people would say to me, my goodness, Beardsley, if you didn't have bad luck, you wouldn't have any luck at all. Again, I never, ever thought about that. But you could take all of those things, the farm accident, the car accident, getting hit by the truck, falling off a cliff, super gluing my eye shut, 20-some surgeries to put my body back together. You could take all of those, put them into a big blender, blend them all up, drink it down, it impales to what happened short time later. I'm a loving dad to my, or I should say a loving husband to my wife, Jill, a loving dad to our boys, Matthew, Christopher, and Andrew, and I'm a drug addict. There's not a lot of difference between me and somebody shooting heroin into their arms or doing meth. My addiction was to narcotic painkillers. And over the years, people have tried to make excuses for me. Oh, it's not your fault, Dick. It wasn't your fault. Those doctors, they gave you all those prescriptions. Baloney. Every doctor I got a prescription from told me the dangers of being on it for too long. None of them forced me to take it. And when I couldn't get this doctor to give me any more, I'd go to another doctor, and then another, and another, and another. It's called doctor shopping, and it's illegal. And then I started doing something that I never even thought of I could even think about do, let alone actually do it. I'd never stolen as much as a piece of bubble gum. I'd never been in any trouble in my life. I started to forge my own prescriptions. I knew I could go to prison. I knew I could lose everything I'd ever worked for in my life, but all that mattered was to get the drugs, take the drugs, and make sure I didn't get caught. What I'm telling you about this part of my life is barely scratching the surface. When I'm asked to speak at a drug treatment center somewhere around our country, that part of my life takes over an hour. By August of 1996, I was taking a cocktail of Valium, Percocet, and Demerol, all very highly addictive drugs, upwards of 80 pills a day. that I didn't die is an absolute miracle. But what's even a bigger miracle, and I thank the good Lord every single day, is that I didn't kill some innocent family. How many times I was driving down a Minnesota highway, barely able to keep my eyes open. How easy it would have been for me to have crossed that center line as I blacked out and ran into some innocent family. It never happened, but it very well could have. Thankfully, on September 30th of 1996, I got caught. I knew I was in a lot of trouble, but I was so thankful and so blessed that I was still alive. And I knew the only chance, if there was any chance at all to get better, was to be 100% truthful and take responsibility for my actions. And that's what I did. Long story short, I didn't have to go to prison. I was given 5 years of probation and 460 hours of community service. But after meeting that afternoon when I got caught with federal drug agents, they took me right to the hospital in Fargo, North Dakota. And for the next 10 days, I was locked up in the psychiatric unit, and they put me on a drug called methadone. It's what they put heroin addicts on. I became addicted to that. They tried to wean me off it the first time, and the withdrawals were so nasty, I honestly thought I was going to die. So they put me back on it, tried to wean me off a little bit slower. The second time was even worse. So they put me back on it and sent me home, thinking, well, maybe if he goes through the withdrawals at home, it'll be easier. The third time was even worse. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. If a family member asked me a question, I would literally bite their head off, because I was so agitated from the withdrawals. Finally, my family put me on a Greyhound bus in Detroit Lakes at 7:30 on a Sunday night. I got into downtown Minneapolis about 1:30 in the morning when a friend picked me up and took me to the University of Minnesota Hospital. They took me to my room, and I laid there and cried in agony all night long. The next morning, they walked me down to where the doctor was, and he said, Dick, methadone withdrawal is one of the worst things a human can go through. You're going to feel like you're going to die. There's going to be times you're going to wish you could die. But I promise you, Dick, we will not let you die. But the next 7 days, in his exact words, are going to be pure hell. The next 7 days, I never slept 1 minute. I would lay in my hospital bed at night, and the pain in my bones, in my arms and legs from the withdrawals was so intense that I can honestly tell you, if I would have had access to a saw, I honestly think I would have sawed them off. In the morning, when it was time to get up, it was a struggle to get my legs on the outside of the bed. And to put on a clean pair of pants and a clean shirt, it seemed like it took me forever. But I never missed a meeting with my group to try to learn how to get better. And there were mornings that I was so sick, I could not stand up and walk down the hallway. I had to crawl on my hands and knees like a dog. And one morning, I'm crawling along the hallway, trying to get down to my group meeting, and I blacked out. When I woke up, I was laying in my own vomit. And I remember looking up and saying, God, please, just take me right now. Or please, God, help get me better. And that night, I actually slept just a little bit. And the next night, a little bit more and a little bit more. And after I'd been there for about 30 days, I started to feel what it was like to be Dick Beardsley without those drugs in my body, and I liked how it made me feel. Has it been easy? It's been one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. Every morning when I wake up, my number one goal for the day is my sobriety. With it, I have everything in the world to live for. Without it, I have nothing. In the last 20 plus years I've had of sobriety, have been some of my best and some of my worst. I never in my wildest dreams ever thought I'd ever have to go through something more difficult than that addiction. I thought, well, thank you, Lord, because you just put me through something, but you got me through it, and now it's all good from here. I'll never face anything this more difficult in my life. My son Andy, we adopted when he was a little boy from Honduras. Little baby, I should say. And at 21, he was so proud to join our military, join the United States Army. And he was proud. To serve his country. And he served a year and a half over in Iraq. He was a gunner in Black Hawk helicopters. And when he wasn't doing that, he was in charge of a crew that when the choppers would come in from the field with the wounded, they would get the wounded off into the medical area. They'd do a mechanical check, refuel, and get the choppers back into the air. During that time he was over there, he saw some things and had to do some things that weren't real pleasant. And when he got back to the U.S., and unfortunately he suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And 22 months ago, my son Andy took his life. It was devastating. I would have done anything for it to be me and not him. And it's been hard to cope with. But what's helped me is I'm not a very good guitar player, but every once in a while, I write songs. I can't just sit down and write a song, but when Andy died, within a couple of months, actually within a few days, I wrote one that I sang at his funeral, but I'm going to share a couple other ones with you. October 4th is a day that I'll never forget. The police showed up on our front doorsteps. They said, sir, your son, he took his life. I had tears in my eyes when I looked at my wife. You know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. But believe in him just like you should. He is great, he is good. You know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. October 10th, we gathered at First Lutheran Church to show our love and to share what his life was worth. We cried and we laughed and we sang some songs. Everybody there tried to be strong. You know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. But believe in him just like you should. He is great, he is good. You know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. October 12th, we laid our boy to rest next to Grandpa Ed. They were best of friends. Then we laid our son into the ground with family and friends. All around, you know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. but believe in him just like you should. He is great, he is good, you know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. Believe in him just like you should. He is great, he is good, you know the Lord he giveth, the Lord taketh away. And then this last song is a song that I wrote. And it brought me peace. And it's called A Day I'll Never Forget. I can't recall one day in my life when I felt as sad as I did that night. I felt like I could lay down and get up no more. It's the saddest feeling, I never felt it before. I thought about all those pills I took years before, how they made me feel so fuzzy and warm. But that's not the way. I've worked too hard through the days, sober and drug free. It's a way for me. And then I asked myself, I said, Dick, where do you go from here? And then I turned. And I looked in the mirror. I saw a crying face looking back at me. I looked up to the Lord. Could you help me, please? And I looked back at that mirror. Looking back at me, it was my sweet boy, my son Andy. He said, Pop, don't cry. I'm doing just fine. I'm here with the Lord. I've got peace of mind. And that's when I knew that I'm gonna be okay. But I'm sure gonna miss my boy all the rest of my days. Thank you, everybody. Take care and God bless you. Thank you very much.